by learning to trade the financial markets, I started to learn how money works, like how it really works, not just how you get paid and use it, but how money goes around in the world at a very fast pace. And it's really, really incredible.
That was the voice of Pierre de Vézian, who will actually come back at the end of the episode. But I thought it was a really good way to start talking about money, to really see that we can learn a lot by studying one specific aspect of money in our world and the way that it's used. So welcome aboard. This is episode number 14. And today we are going to have three guests, the first one being DB, who is a Putty Tribe member and has already been on the Multipod previously. He will share with me his concept of money and how he looks at it. Next, we'll have Heather. She's also a Putty Tribe member, and she's just written a book that's been published, so she's very happy about that. And she's going to share the aspect of money that's more geared towards worth and value as a Multipod. And finally, we will close the episode with Pierre de Vézian, who's going to talk to us about saving money and investing money and trading and some very interesting angles of approaching the whole money aspect of things. Okay, so this is my next guest, and I'm really happy to welcome DB once again to the show. And today, of course, we're going to continue our conversation about money, but we're going to bring another angle to it. And so I'd like DB to talk about what he really wants to share with us. So welcome aboard again, DB.
Hi, glad to be here. Thanks for having me on again. So all across the forum, people keep talking to me and to everybody really about satisfaction and meaning and, you know, how they have all these interests and passions or career options. And at the end of the day, they struggle with this. And sure, we're MPs, we're multi-potentialites. We all struggle with the vastness of our interests and everything. But the important part, and Darren and I were even talking about that this morning, is keeping the lights on. So at the end of the day, who you are and what you do aren't the same thing. And they shouldn't have to be the same thing either. You just have to keep the lights on, you know? So that's really my take on this whole money struggle philosophy thing is, if you keep the lights on and you do something that gives you enough money to live, it's not necessarily as important that that defines you, because it's not who you are at all, really. You are vastly greater and more interesting than your job or your company or your side hustle or whatever you want to call your income stream. That being said, you don't exist if you don't get food, somewhere to live, you know, things to help make life livable. So, you know, separate the two is really what I'm saying, and make sure that you do what you need to do to just keep the lights on.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, if you're a big consumer and you're into this like overconsumption that we're all witnessing everywhere around the world, your financial needs will be greater, because now you really think you need and want that latest car, and you really think you need and want the beautiful clothing that's got that name on it, that, you know, the branding that you like, etc. So then your cost of living will go up, right? Because now you need that car, you need to maintain it, you need to pay for all this stuff. And so all of a sudden your income has to be much greater. But if you start thinking to yourself, well, do those things really make me happy, or do they just fulfill this one thing that I think is important, but in the end, is it really important? And so that comes down to the questions you're talking about, right? Fulfillment. Am I fulfilled, or am I just spending money on things that are actually not helping my happiness levels?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, David Shipler wrote this book a while back. It was called The Working Poor, Invisible in America. And it's an American slant on the idea, but the term the working poor is kind of an interesting economic idea, right? There are these people, the vast majority of people who are poor, who work all the time, right? And they're constantly doing things that make money, and yet they're very much so economically poor, right? And what's interesting about that is that the poor part is an economic indicator. You know, it's based on how much money you have, how much money you make, et cetera, et cetera. But the working part isn't. And there's this, I guess, other end of the spectrum, sort of example, counterexample of the working rich. And it's the same thing. There are people who, on paper, are absolute millionaires. You know, some of them, you know, tens of millions. And they work all the time. And their cash flow is, you know, every year it's $1 million in, but it's also $1 million out. They have no real tangible assets. They just have this giant cash flow, right? And that's a very, very bad place to be in, regardless of how much money you make, because you're not, and this is another phrase that I'm very fond of saying, you're not killing more than you eat. it's a very, you know, very sort of tribal way to look at that, but at the end of the day, you have to kill more than you eat.
Yeah. Whenever I look at, you know, if you drive through a really wealthy neighborhood, or you watch a movie and you see these like mansions, and they've got the three beautiful cars and this and the in-ground pool and all that stuff, and you kind of go, wow, you know, you look at this going, wow. And it's so easy to get to look at that, and you know, you could get really envious really fast and say, man, I wish I had this and I wish I had that. And a lot of times, you know, because I'm a mom and because I've got a 12-year-old and I've got an 18-year-old, I look at them and I say, guys, you know, be careful how impressed you're going to get by these things, because nothing, you don't know what that family is living. You don't know if they're living beyond their means. You don't know if they're in debt so high that they can't even pay any of this stuff off. You don't know how much savings they have. You don't know if they're not going to end up in a two-bedroom apartment in a year because they've lived higher than they can, and one of them loses their job and that's it, end of story, like that's it, you know, the game over. And so that's something that, as you say, you know, sometimes you look at these working rich and you look at the working poor, and we feel bad for the working poor, and we feel almost, you know, in certain ways we can feel envious of the working rich. But until you know what each story is, and until you know how truly wealthy or truly well managed their finances are, you can't make an opinion. You can't really have a thought in your head that makes sense. At least that's my perspective on it. Every time I look at that, I go, you know what? I don't know. I don't know what the true story is there. I don't know how stressed out they are about having all those means, right? Because if you have all those things, but you don't own half of them because it's all leased, well, you might have a higher level of stress than I do. You know, I don't have the in-ground pool, but I don't have to maintain the in-ground pool either. I don't have to bring the guy, you know, and make sure, and then there's a leak and there's this and there's that. I don't have to maintain all that stuff. And there's money that goes into that, right?
Yeah, there's a commercial. I'm sure you could probably find it on YouTube somewhere. But it's a financial management commercial. It's like Prudential or something like that. And there's this video of this family that's living this amazing dream life. And then the camera turns to the patriarch of this family, and he says, "How do I do it?" And you know, they zoom in on his face, and he goes, I'm in debt up to my eyeballs.
Exactly.
Flash the logo.
Exactly. Right? So that's, yeah. I think it's a good reminder. I think when some of us might not feel as wealthy as the wealthy, we might actually be wealthier than the apparent wealthy. And the wealth should remain in how happy do you feel day in, day out, and how free do you feel? Like the freedom of knowing that, you know what, even if I don't make 7,000 this month, no worries. I can still keep the lights on, as you started the interview with, right? Let's keep the lights on. Like, what do you need to do to keep the lights on? Am I going to starve next month if I don't make that $5,000 contract, or am I good to go? You know, so it should probably be that should be the triggering force behind our concept of money. What else can you share with us with regards to that?
So I had a very interesting conversation with a friend the other day. And it got into the idea of how money skews our perception of value, and how money also, it's completely arbitrary, sure, but also there are these income inequalities and production inequalities and economic, you know, levers and dials and things that really shape how we think about things. And what started this whole, you know, thought process and everything is I asked a friend a question. I said, you know, which is more expensive, an iPhone or a blueberry muffin? Not a trick question. iPhone costs up to $1,000. Blueberry muffin, you're going to spend tops $2 or $3 at the most, right? iPhone is obviously more expensive than a blueberry muffin, right? So the next question, which is more complicated, a blueberry muffin or an iPhone? Your first answer, what you want to say is, well, the iPhone's more complicated. That's why it's more expensive. You know, it's harder to make, it does more things, it's a computer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The iPhone absolutely has to be more complicated. It's not true. Blueberry muffin is 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, There's this nuclear fusion reactor thousands of trillions of miles away that optically beams energy to a factory that creates complex molecular molecules via quantum physics to self-replicate complex organic energy sources that also self-replicate. And that's just the blueberries. You know? It took billions of years for blueberries to exist. That's a long time in R&D. An iPhone? You're talking what? Tops, maybe 5 years? Right? iPhone's easy. iPhone's not complicated at all. Can you grow an iPhone? No, you can't grow an iPhone. But you can grow a blueberry. And because of that, blueberry production is seasonal, right? It's dependent on the weather. It's dependent on astronomy. iPhone production? You can build an iPhone underground in a cave all year round, right? Because it's not that complicated. A robot can do it. It's not that complicated. And yet, the iPhone is so much more expensive than the blueberry muffin, right? Now, why is that? Why on earth do we let ourselves come to that position, right? There's lots of answers to that question. But at the end of the day, it's because we don't necessarily have our costs and our values as humanity, as societies, as countries. They're not aligned, you know?
Yeah, that's so true. No, that you mentioned it. It's funny because actually when you were explaining the difference between the blueberry and the well, first when you're explaining the blueberry itself and the blueberry muffin in further down, I believe what the thing that came back to me was a teacher one day in university who explained to me that building an airplane was complicated, but making spaghetti and meatballs was complex. And I think that's what you were trying to say in different words, but it was mm-hmm. funny how for me, your definition of the blueberry was actually complex, whereas the definition of the iPhone was complicated. And the reason why his answer to complex, like to really define complexity, was the fact that you cannot re-separate easily every single molecule and every single piece of tomato and every single ingredient that goes into the tomato sauce or even into the spaghetti itself. And so that's why spaghetti and meatballs are complex and building an airplane is complicated, because it's all steps and separate parts, and it's all, you can all replicate it pretty easily if you have the proper machinery, but it's doable. You can take it apart. It's doable. Whereas anything that's organic, you're right, is not doable. And so it brings it back to the value. We don't attribute value as much to growing vegetables and fruit and all the work that goes into, like, it's actually, that's another conversation I have a lot with kids is, you know, when they complain about food, oh, I don't like this, or I didn't like the way it was prepared. It's like, wait, hang on just a second. First of all, you got to thank Mother Earth for providing this to you for that organic ingredient. Then you got to thank the person who actually worked their butt off all day in the fields, picking out those things and bringing them to the factory. And then you got to thank the driver of the truck yeah. who drove the truck to your grocery store nearby or your whatever. And then you got to thank everybody else along the way. And then your mom or your dad for paying for that food and working so that it can come to your table. And then for the person who prepared it for you at the last step of the process. So you cannot complain about the food that's on your plate. It's on your plate because there's a lot of people and Mother Earth and nature who work to make it happen. So it's, again, it's bringing back value. But imagine if we were to bring that price bracket up for all those steps for us to get that plate, you know, to eat that plate of food, man, like it would be, we find the cost of food is high. It would be just like $1 million plate every day.
And that's the beauty of it, is what you're talking about is value chains from a economic jargon point of view, value chains, right? So this is one of the reasons why an iPhone costs more than a blueberry muffin, right? A blueberry muffin has a much longer value chain than an iPhone does. There are more people involved, more companies involved, all of that. And each one has to live. So they each pull a little bit of money out as it goes down, right? The iPhone, on the other hand, is exclusively made by Apple, who only uses a few number of vendors, right?
Yep.
So the amount of money that each part of that value chain pulls out is proportionately greater, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what you end up with is, because there are fewer players, each one of them says, well, you know, I'm the only one that does this, so I'm going to charge more. So that's why the iPhone, from an economic point of view, is more expensive. Because basically, if you want blueberries, like if you absolutely desperately needed blueberries, you could go back into your yard and grow blueberries, right? Yes. And you would have blueberries without any of the arbitrage of currency, right?
Yeah.
So that's it. That's the problem, right? And you hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, you have to thank all the people involved in this. Those people aren't being thanked. And more importantly, they're not being paid.
No.
Right?
No.
Not a fair value or a true wage or a living wage or whatever you want to call it, right? None of that's happening. And it's because, you know, people are horrible and terrible and selfish. And at the end of the day, somebody else will say, well, I can do it for 2 cents cheaper. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. It's just the law of offer and demand. And as long as somebody's willing to pay less or not think of the consequences of that human value that you're now diminishing, then yeah, we'll always have that issue, right? So
yeah, absolutely. We may have strayed a little bit more into philosophy and economics, but it's
all part of it, right? I mean, and that's how you started off the whole conversation, was really talking about, you know, how much do people value themselves and what's our worth? And so we'll be talking more about that with Heather. We'll be talking about the value of each person and how do we feel with regards to our own value. So we'll have that conversation, but it's all really linked to that. It's all linked to money. Isn't just money, at least not in my head. Money isn't just money. Money is linked to culture. It's linked to who you are. It's linked to your self-esteem and your dignity. And you have to balance those things and keep an equilibrium as much as possible, which is very difficult to do.
Yeah, absolutely. It reminds me of a scene from, I think it was a movie I saw at one point, but, you know, there are these people and they're traveling and they end up in a very, very poor sort of stereotypical Eastern European country. And they tip their waiter a quarter. And the waiter grabs the quarter and turns to the manager and he says, do you see this? I quit. I'm opening my own restaurant.
Wow. That's crazy, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy, but yeah. No, it's all, like we said, it's all value chains and differentials and, oh, so many complicated and yet really not that complicated things. Anyways, so that's my 2 cents.
Thank you very much, DB. It's been enlightening again, and hope to see you again in another episode of the Multipod. And until then, be well and be happy and remain valuable.
Thanks, same to you.
Have a good one. Hello again. So I am here right now with Heather, and I'm not even going to try to say your last names because I think I'm going to mess them up, but I'll let you introduce your last names. But Heather, you've been a Multipod for a long time, and you've been a member of the Putty Tribe for a while, I believe. So welcome on to our episode about money.
Hi. It's Usri Knight. That's okay. I totally confound people sometimes. So.
Great. And so how long have you been a member of the Putty Tribe?
Since the end of 2015. And that was the same time that I had watched the TED Talk and sort of had that revelation that a lot of people have, I think. So, and then I joined right after that. So I think it was like December 2015.
Okay, and if you were to describe yourself in a few sentences with regards to what your activities are in life, they would be?
Well, right now I'm currently trying to build businesses, so it's apropos. And I'm trying to just sort of like settle into that idea of what does that mean to sort of go forward in something solid. I live with a specialist, a really hardcore specialist. So that kind of brings a lot of tension into my life about money and those kind of things. So,
wow. So let's jump right in. So what are your views on money? What are your views on money, especially because we're not specialists? What does it mean to you, and what role has it played in your life and since you've been an adult or even before?
Well, actually, I grew up really poor. Like, my mom struggled to put food on the table. But then eventually she had gone back to school and gotten a PhD. And then, you know, we started sort of moving up into the middle class. And so for me, money was kind of something that, like, you were always sort of seeking in some way. Like, she was always saying, when we get there, we'll get toys. And that meant like maybe a boat or like some sort of cool thing that you could use to do fun things, you know, like sort right. of ignoring the fact that we did fun things without the need for those toys, quote unquote. So I would say, you know, we're lower middle class when I was growing up, and but I never really had the sense that, like, so there was this sort of seeking for it, but there wasn't this sense that, like, oh my God, we had to have it or we're you know, done for. Although I think, and my husband also grew up pretty poor, I think it left left me with this kind of like sort of dislike for it. And you and I have talked about that prior, that just sort of this really intense dislike for like, oh, like now I have to sell myself for money. And I think like my husband's a therapist, so he is selling himself for money and he's doing really, really well at it. But I think we as scanners, like, because we have such a broad range of how we might make money, and I would say a great deal of us are entrepreneurs, so maybe kind of creating our own way in terms of the money world, just because often regular or specific jobs don't really have space for us in certain ways. I think that's changing a great deal, but at least in my generation, it came that you were in a place for a long time, you built up a retirement, and then you retired and that was it. And I think that's changing a lot now. I'm Generation X. I don't have savings, right? You know, talking about that way of like having something going forward. But I think we struggle more probably, you know, like someone who goes in and works for a long time and they have this kind of stability. Whereas being an entrepreneur is very difficult. It's, and if you don't have that drive, I don't have that specific kind of drive. It is really, really hard and it takes a lot of work. And so I think that there's a way in which a lot of people just kind of end up struggling in that space. Like, how do I build this business that will make me money? Like, I want to do things that I love and I want to do many things that I love. But how do I build those that will create an income? And so I think that then also ties into skill, right? So nobody sits down and teaches you how to be Entrepreneur 101. You know, like if you're going through school and you're doing something very specific, then maybe you have an idea of like kind of, oh, I could go in and, you know, build a practice and become a therapist and market myself. That's still work, but, it has more of a linear, track. Yeah. So, and I think the other thing is self-esteem. I think that's number two. So it's like, maybe it's a lack of skill of building those businesses. Maybe it's a lack of understanding marketing and how to get yourself out there. Because there are successful multipods, right? Like there are people who seem to have that that drive and that organization and can go forward. And I think a great deal of us who, again, those who don't have that in the first place, you know, we grew up with this very particular message of, and I've heard this over and over and over from various multipods saying, I thought I was broken for so long.
Right.
Yeah. And when you're broken or you think you are, there's a lot of, sense of depression, which is going to block a lot of that motivation to move forward and kind of really put yourself in there. Your self-esteem is of course affected. Like if you're broken, then, you know, I'm not good enough to do any new things to put myself out there. And that's really going to affect, how you put your, literally put yourself out there for, your services, for your goods, for whatever your, it is that you're offering.
And I think, one of the things, if we look at the way entrepreneurial works, like to be an entrepreneur, what does it mean? I've noticed from the coaching that I do with entrepreneurs that the entrepreneurs who tend to do the best, who tend to succeed the most, are entrepreneurs whose parents or somebody close in their family was an entrepreneur and they saw them when they were growing up. Because one of the main things that defines and differentiates an entrepreneur to an employee is a person who, without having to be somewhere, without somebody expecting them to show up somewhere, they know that they have to be somewhere. So they make themselves be in that place. And it doesn't have to be a different place. It can be at home, but they end up going to their workplace. So their office in their house at 8 a.m. in the morning, and they come home from work at 5 p.m. at night and they've done their work, right? So they've put into that endeavor. They've put in the 30, 40, 50 hours a week that they would in a job where they would get paid a salary. And, but that motivation often comes from they saw their parent do that, right? Or they saw their uncle do that, or they saw somebody close and they went to see them at work and they realized that they don't need a boss to tell them you better show up at 8 o'clock because if you're not here at 8 o'clock, you're fired. They know that that's not going to happen to them, but they would have to fire themselves, right? And so a lot of times when you see, if you, somebody who's a multipod and decides to be an entrepreneur with three endeavors or two endeavors or five or however many they want to decide to build, they have to have that conviction and that certainty that the only way it's going to work is if I put in the hours and I put in the time. Now, I can right away be devil's advocate and turn that right around and say, well, hang on, how about, you know, Tim Ferriss's 4-hour work week, right? Which basically shows you that you can be really, really very productive by putting in less hours a week. But nonetheless, it's the mindset of saying, I'm going to work for me, and it's just as important and as demanding as working for somebody else. But that's not easy to do when there doesn't seem to be a clear and concrete consequence to not doing that. You know, when you're working for somebody else, there's a clear and concrete consequence. If you don't show up, you're out of a job and that money stops coming in. Well, when you're an entrepreneur, if you don't show up, the money's not going to come in. But sometimes if you do show up, it might not come in either because it'll take a while for it to come in. So the consequence isn't as clear and you know, precise. It's kind of like floating there in the background. Oh, I'll figure it out. Oh, I'll find a way, or something will happen, or oh, I'll use some of my savings, or you know, eventually it'll come, and oh, it's okay if I put in less hours. I'm good at this, or you know. So there's that fluctuation in your head, and so it ends up coming back to, well, how much do you value each of your hours, right? So the worth. So it brings me to my next question to you is, how does a multipod build their worth?
That's a complicated question, and my background in psychology immediately just wants to, you know, like worth is so complex. We have, unfortunately, I think in this society, really entwined it with money. You know, if I'm worth anything, then I can get that big mansion and that car and kind of all the stuff. And so there's this sort of extrinsic reward system that we have going on. And I think that we as scanners get caught up in that particular system. But we have a pull because we have all these different passions. We have a pull for that intrinsic reward. Like we want to do what we really love because I think we understand that one, it's really hard to choose. And so therefore, you know, I have all these things on my plate that I want to honor. But that I think there's this way in which we kind of truly understand that to not do those things is to be miserable. And so that's a super complicated question because I think first you have to learn how to unentangle yourself, individually. And of course, each individual then has their own complex equation with money and their, you know, how they grew up with it. And so they have to untangle themselves from that particular idea that value is this sort of like, I'm now valuable because I have become successful in some way monetarily. There are many ways to be successful, obviously. And so I think it's like learning how to do that. That's part of kind of that journey and really recognizing. And I've talked to multi-peeps before because it's, you know, one of the things that we have to go through is sort of one, the realization, this is what I am. Two, integrating that into, hey, that's okay. I'm not broken. And then three, starting to look towards how you can be valuable to the world, to your community, to just sort of the outside of you. And yeah, money does enter into that because we are in a capitalist society where you do have to spend money to, you know, take care of the basic needs. But I think that is part of the journey of learning what it means to be a scanner. So
the first thing that came through my mind was, but wait, aren't we valuable, period? Like, don't we have value just by being who we are?
Absolutely.
And that's the part that we're forgetting, right? That's the part that when we, as multipods, have moments of struggle financially, we go, well, that's because I'm not worth anything. And that's when it goes, hang on, you're not just worth something because you're making $100,000 a year. You're worth something regardless of whether you make $10,000, zero, or $500,000. You're worth all the same. It's just you're able to get that extrinsic element into your life and bring it to you, or you're not. And that's just putting yourself out there, everything you said before, but it's not linked to the value. And I think that's the hardest part that we have to deal with, because of that first thought that, oh, if I'm a multipod, I'm obviously broken because the rest of society wants me to be a specialist. And as you said, it's changing.
Right. And I think, again, that desire to like live within that space of like, this is my passion, or my passions, I should say, for us, that there's the intrinsic, you know, that sort of that reward. Like, there are so many, we're really into abstract expressionist painters here, and there were so many that like didn't make any money until after they died, right? Mm. Like, look at their paintings and you're like, this is so amazing. And right. So that value, it's like they are, and that's what I meant by that worth, like we're worth to, you know, I believe everybody's got a unique gift that they can give to the universe, and the universe wants you to give that gift. Mm. And so then it becomes like, but that can become like, okay, I've got this thing, you know, I've got this gift that I need to get out there, but then I'm dealing with all of this sort of societal stuff and psychological internalized stuff, in order to like, how do I bring those together in this practical world of still having to make money? And I think worth can become very tainted with inner critics, just constantly sort of, and that can push you to not put yourself out there, you know, like,
yeah, because even just the way society functions, you know, what's the first question you get asked when you go to a barbecue, or when you go to even if it's not a professional event, if it's a family affair, so what do you do?
How do you do? Yeah.
You know, what do you do? It's not, hey, what's your story, or who are you, or I'm curious, what are your passions? No, it's never that question. It's always, what do you do? And then it even goes further, because if what you do is, well, I'm a coach, or I'm a therapist, or I'm a this, or I'm a that. And, oh, and so, you know, do you have a lot of clients? So the next question is always basically, how can you possibly make a living out of this, right? The underlying sentence is that. And so then all of a sudden you start feeling, why am I feeling this yucky, you know, kind of sentiment that I'm not succeeding when, damn it, I think I am, right? So then you feel like you're in justification mode for the next 10 minutes, and you're going, why? Because somebody else is paying for your life because you get a paycheck, and I'm making my own worth. I should be feeling worth, like, less worthy than you. You know, you have to really just stay away from that and go, that doesn't belong to me. That's not mine. That's their perception. That's their fears. Maybe they knew somebody that was an entrepreneur and always had struggles throughout their lives, and they'll only believe that you're doing well the day your name is out there on a big, you know, billboard or something.
Right. Yeah.
So any last words of wisdom for our listeners to how to work out the worth aspect and the money aspect?
Well, being a prior therapist, I believe that everyone should be in therapy. So that would be one, like seeking help to really talk through a lot of those self-esteem issues, talking to other peeps that maybe have kind of been peeps for a while and have had a chance to sort of start integrating. And the third, which is probably going to utilize a lot of the first two, is taking risks. So working through that fear of taking risks, you know, again, utilizing a professional, utilizing other peeps to get to a place where it might just have to be like, I'm going to put myself out there, and that's going to take a scary leap, and maybe it won't be successful. Maybe it will. Maybe I just have to shift something to make it successful, but it is risk. And risk doesn't have to be, I think we take that as a negative word. And so maybe kind of also learning how to shift and redefine risk in terms of like, instead of something like, oh my God, super scary, but something kind of amazing to engage instead. So I would say those are kind of the three main things. And the first two obviously are going to help shift a lot of those attitudes. And then the third is really just kind of doing it. Like when I was doing this book to publish, I just was like, it's never going to make money. like it's horrible. All the writing's awful, right? That's a big artist or probably even peep story. But I finally just said, you know what? I'm just going to put it out there because I need to do that. I need to challenge myself. I need to move forward in that way. And I did. I'm still kind of working through that, like the quality of the feeling that came up around that. But yeah, that challenging those beliefs, challenging the stories, like really the stories that we tell ourselves about money, about worth, really just getting in there and digging in and exploring them and starting to change those stories.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation, and thanks for being on the show. Hopefully we'll have you on the show again for another topic next time, and hope your book will do immensely well.
Thank you.
What's the name of the book?
It's called Lizard Dreams, and it's Heather UK, like it is on the tribe, Lizard Dreams, and it's a collection of short stories that I've been working on for years. This book took years just because of a lot of those fears. So,
but good, you did it. You published it. So we'll be looking out for it. Thank you so much.
Cool. Thank you, Sandrine.
You're welcome. So I'm here today with one of our Putty Tribe members, and his name is Pierre de Vizian. Pierre, you are from France, but you've also lived in Germany and in Spain. And so, Pierre, you speak fluently French, Spanish, German, and you say you're not fluent in English, but I think you're fluent in English. and you're also you also speak bits of, wow, Italian, Portuguese, Mandarin, Russian, Arabic, and Welsh. That's a huge collection of very diverse languages.
Yeah.
So you really love to learn, which is it's shown here in your biography. But I think that also is important to mention everything that you're interested in. And so you're interested in really a diverse wealth of subjects, whether it's books and history and movies and science, TV shows, but also sci-fi, food, and the stock market, and creating websites. Did I forget anything?
A lot of things, but that's a good start.
Okay. So welcome to our show. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us today about our very, it's a wide subject, money. I think we can approach it from many different angles. Maybe to jump into the subject, how did you even get started on stock market trading, and how does somebody even start there?
Well, my story on that goes back a really, really long time ago. And I was a kid and I loved making money as a kid. Like, I don't know, cooking dinner in exchange for a small pay, going gardening and stuff like that. So small household maintenance. I love to do it and then get a little bit of money from that. And then I discovered somehow, one day I picked up my grandparents' newspaper and I saw those weird numbers and symbols and percentages. And I was, what is that? Oh, that's a stock market. Okay, how does it work? And I didn't quite understand it because I was a little bit too young, I think, to understand the complexities behind it. But I started to track the progress of a few companies, And then I learned that one of my family members worked for a publicly traded company. So I told her, yeah, you have to buy shares, and I want you to buy shares for me so that when I'm 18, I can use them. So I can sit at board members, board meetings, and so on. So I can really help a company. That was my dream behind it, you know, like buying shares and then turn that into control of the company.
Wow.
Well, at the time, I was a little bit naive because it doesn't work like that, because you would need to buy a lot of shares in order to be able to do that. But it was interesting. And then 2 years ago, I made a mistake at the time. But now, as I reflect on it, it was a big learning curve for me, because I started working for a friend with the startup he just created, and he didn't raise enough money to pay me, so I had to quit. And I started, I tried freelancing, but I wasn't really mature for it yet. I didn't know the business side of it. I just knew the work side of it. And so I started looking into, you know, how to make money. And there are a lot of ways, you know, you can earn a few bucks here and there using some apps, doing little stuff, but that doesn't pay well. And it's really boring. So I love the movie, The Wolf of Wall Street. I love that movie. And I remembered that Jordan Belfort used to sell pink sheet stocks. So then I started searching.
Can you just explain what a pink sheet stock is?
Yes. It's a publicly traded company that doesn't cost much, usually under a dollar, but you can find some that are under 10.
So is that what we call a penny stock? Is that would be the same thing as
yes,
a penny stock?
Yes, pink sheets are a subcategory of penny stocks.
Okay.
So pink sheets were traditionally only exchanged in physical form with real pink sheets. They're called pink sheets. And so I started looking into that, and it was really fascinating, because then I learned that Jordan Belfort was what's called a pump and dumper. So he was the guy who manipulates the stock to go up, and then he sells everything he has. Investors lose all their money, but he makes millions. Because when a stock that costs 1 cent goes to $2, and you have, I don't know, let's just say 1,000 shares, you make like around 2,000 bucks. Okay, but he had like 1 million shares, so he would make just 1 million from that, while his investors would lose money. And so that was very interesting, because I thought, you know, there must be other guys promoting cheap stocks and then selling when it's high and making a profit off of the stupidity of people who trust them. And that's okay. These people don't know what a stock manipulation is. They just want to make money magically, you know, overnight. So it's a mix between ignorance and stupidity. Because when you don't know something, it's not really stupidity, but yeah. So I started searching, you know, how can I make money of these people, of these promoters that are manipulating a stock, which is illegal. And there are basically two ways you can make money: when it goes up, and you can make money when it goes down, which most people don't know. Most people just think, yeah, I can make money when it goes up. But there's something called shorting. Shorting a stock is betting against it. You're betting that it will go down. It's a little bit more risky that traditional buying low, selling high, because this is selling high and buying low. And the downside of it is that you can go bankrupt, because if it goes too high and you have to buy very, very high, then you can lose all your money, because at one point you have to buy back again, because the shares you're using are actually not yours.
Right. Yeah.
They're borrows.
Yeah, they're
so
borrows.
You have to borrow shares, sell them short, and then buy them and return them. Nowadays, it's automatic thanks to all the internet brokers. But it has existed for quite a while, I think around 50 years in the US markets. And most people don't know about it, and it's a great way to make money, because when the stock goes up from 1 to 3 and then cracks down and goes back to 2, you can make money between 1 and 3. So you can make $2 per share, and then you can make $1 per share when it goes down from 1 to 2, from 3 to 2.
3 to 2, yeah.
So you can make more money, and a lot of stocks go down every day. And if you know the right patterns, you can make money off that. Not just going up, but also going down. And one movie about that I loved, because I love watching movies, was about the 2008 financial crisis. And it was about guys who found a way, who found out that the financial markets were about to go down. They just didn't know exactly when. They knew it was going to happen, but they didn't know exactly when. One guy spotted it in 2005. And he went to banks and found a way to short the financial market. And the movie was really interesting because it's based on a real story. It has great actors, and it's kind of hard to follow if you don't know the
methodology behind it.
No, not just the methodology, but the words. You right. know the financial terms that are
the
behind.
Jargon. Yes, the jargon.
Yeah, the jargon. Thank you. And but the movie is actually not that hard to understand for newbies. It's okay. Just don't read the book if you don't know a lot about it, because the book really goes into detail, and I was lost while reading the book. I mean, it was very interesting, but I had to Google every, like, 3 words from every page, because there were terms that I just didn't understand. Okay. But it was very interesting on how these guys spotted that it was coming. And the main lesson from the movie and the book is that not everything goes up eternally. It can, but if it does, it always at one point goes down. You will always have what we call corrections, market corrections, or what are even worse, crashes, because crashes are really, really violent. That's what happened in 2008. And then you have recessions where you're recovering, and then it goes really back up. So it's really a cycle, because when something goes up, it goes down a little bit, so it can go up even stronger. It has to get a correction. And if people know about these corrections, they can make money on the downside when it goes down, because they can short. And they can protect themselves, because they know that if it goes down too much, it will take some time to go back up. And a great investor, one of the greatest investors in the world, Warren Buffett, actually made a lot of money during the financial crisis, because he saw it coming, as well as these other guys, but he didn't bet against the financial market. He just sold around the top, and then it went down. And as it went down, he bought, he bought. He bought, and then at one point it started to go back up, and then he stopped. He kept on buying, but then he slowly stopped buying, and it kept going up, 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 and it reached the point where we were in 2008, and it kept going up. So he spotted that there was a downtrend coming. He bought during the downtrend, and then it went back up. So he made even more money than if he bought before the crisis, which is one of the smartest ways to make money without a lot of risk.
Yeah.
If you know something is going to go back up, if you know that the country is stable enough to bounce back from a crisis, if you know that the US government is going to save banks that messed up, that it was really stupidity and greed that made banks like Lehman Brothers that never recovered, that they lost a lot of money. And if you know that the government is going to save them, then you know that the markets are going to go back up. So you know when you can invest. Yeah, that's my story.
Great. It's a lot. It's already so much wealth of knowledge. Have you thought of giving courses or preparing like how-tos, you know, step-by-step instructions, and then selling those to people to learn about this, like this, just the things that you shared? You know, there's a lot of documentation out there. There's a lot of websites out there. There's a lot of people selling lots of stuff about the stock market. But I think a lot of what's being sold out there is lots of promises, which are totally not materialized, right? I mean, a lot of these, you read these websites about investing in the stock market, and half of it, you're like, you know, you can tell it's just, it doesn't make any sense, right? Because they're always, they're trying to promise you stuff that nobody can promise anything in the stock market. But I was just wondering if you had thought of maybe doing some modules or something, or if
that's— I did, but it would only be for beginners who don't know anything about it. For people who, you know, would want to make some money, but wouldn't want to make too much money. Like, the things I could teach wouldn't make you a millionaire.
Right.
But they could, you know, help you make some money along the way, or they would help you protect your savings.
Right.
For example, because some of the savings accounts are correlated with the financial markets. And if the financial markets go down, then the savings accounts that are correlated will go down as well. Mm-hmm. So you have to know when you invest in some financial products like a savings account, a 401k, stuff like that, that sometimes they're correlated with the market. And then you can't be surprised if you lose money when the markets go down. Mm. And so, yeah, maybe something for beginners to help them understand a little bit how the whole thing works, because it's always moving and it's never really going up or down or sideways. It's always moving, and you can't really predict where it's going to go on the long term unless you're inside the company. For example, if you work for a company, you can know if it's going to go up for a long way or not for a long time. Sorry. And that's also the difference between investing and trading. What I do is trading. Investing is looking at something, putting money into it. That's my vision of it. But it's looking at something like a stock, putting money into it, and then looking back once a week to see how it goes.
Yeah.
Or not looking back at all, and then looking at it once a year to see how it's performing. Trading, on the other hand, is, to me, a little less risky, because you're the one in control of your money, because you buy and sell within a short term.
Yeah.
So there are several types of trading. To me, the hardest one to learn is day trading.
Yeah.
Because it requires you to be in front of the computer and look at the charts, and not only the charts, but also what's called level two, which is the live exchanges, and you can see how much people want to buy the stock for and how much they want to sell it for live. And you have to calculate, it's going up, it's going down, and you bet on moves. Typically in the penny stock world, you bet on 10 cents move or 20 cents move, and you're kind of sitting there in front of the computer for 2 hours waiting for the stock to move cent by cent by cent until it moves 20 cent when you can sell.
Yeah.
So it's really stressful, and I tried it, and I got some gray hairs from it. So it's not really my style. So everyone has to find their style.
Yeah.
It's other people's styles, and I know people who have made millions from it.
Yeah.
But it's not my style. My style is a little bit more patient and not stressing out about it, you know, giving it some room to move, going, do other things. So then there is the approach I use, which is swing trading, which is basically you buy a stock or you short a stock, and you give it at least a day to make the move. Or it can be a week, or it can be a month. But every day you check in and see how it goes and see if it's going along your plan. Because trading is not just betting. It's making a plan and following the plan. Mm-hmm. And if at one point the stock doesn't follow the plan, you sell or you exit.
Yeah.
You get out of your position, even if it's a loss. Because a loss can quickly go into bankruptcy.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
This is really interesting. But I have one last question for you. How do you not look back? Like, let's say you say to yourself, I'm going to buy this stock at 50 cents. And when it reaches 75 cents, I'm out. And you stick to your guns. It reaches 75 cents or maybe 77 and you sell at 77. You go, great, I made 2 cents more than planned, but I'm out. And then you see it rise and rise and rise and rise. And it might go down. And then for the next few weeks, you see it go up to like a dollar. You're like, shit, I could have made, 23 cents more per share. How do you not look back? How do you, do you let it go? Do you go back to it? Do you end up buying again and trying to get that extra 20 cents? What do you do?
Maybe. Well, there's one thing is that I try not to revenge trade, which is when something didn't go according to plan. If you lost money and you want to make it back, or if you made money, but you know you could make a lot more, that's revenge trading. You want your revenge on the markets. And the thing is that the markets aren't a person you can just box in and hurt. And it's a machine that is way more powerful than you. And if you're stupid, it will destroy you.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It doesn't do what you want.
All right.
It does what it wants.
Right.
And it's so autonomous.
Just let it go.
Yeah, you learn to let it go. Yeah. It's over time. You have to train. And then over time, you will learn, okay, because if you have a system that works, you have to trust your system.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like if you start doubting your training, then you should go back to train because you're not ready. And as soon as you understand that you give yourself and that you trust your training 100% and that you know that your system works, then you know that you can live with losses, even if they're big, and you can live with wins that weren't as big as they could have been because your system works. Mm. If you have a system that consistently makes you 20% each time you trade, statistically, then why would you want to worry about making 2 cents more?
Yeah.
If you make 20% every single week, that's great.
Yeah.
Why would you want to, that's just greed. And stupidity and greed makes people lose a lot of money.
Well, thank you very much, Pierre. It's been really interesting. And I hope that you continue to enjoy all your different passions. And definitely, you know a lot about trading in the stock market. And if I may, you might want to do a huddle about it or something on the Putty Tribe.
Well,
I'm sure people will enjoy
it. There's going to be a huddle on July 2nd.
Oh.
For people to go in and ask me questions about my passions or things I know or maybe things I don't know.
Okay, so unfortunately by the time this episode comes out, July 2nd will have passed. So
okay, but maybe we'll make another event
okay.
because it's the first. So
okay, cool.
And there's always the topic on the forum, which is called AMA, so Ask Me Anything.
Yes.
So people can just come in and ask me questions, and there's always direct messaging. And well, two things I wanted to say before we part ways. The first thing is that I recommend people that don't know much about the financial markets learn about compounded interest. That's a very important thing. And it basically allows you to turn $1,000 into $20,000 over 20 years. That's compounded interest. And it's very powerful. And a lot of people just assume you can make money and like you can make magical money, you know? And compounded interest is kind of that way to magically make money if you invest it well. If you have a retirement account that pays you 1% every year, that's great because over 20 years, you won't have made 20%, but you will have made 1% plus 1% on the whole thing, plus 1% on the whole thing again. So it's compounded. Every time you make 1%, it will be used next year to make 1% again over that. So it's really powerful. And the other thing is for people to save money. If people don't know really how to save money, the number one philosophy I use is every time I spend money, the first thing I do is calculate how much time of work it would take me to make that money back. And if it's worth that sum of money. For things like getting cigarettes or getting a new car that's not really worth it but would make you feel great, is it really worth it to work an extra year just to have that great car?
Exactly.
I mean, yeah. I don't think it is. It's just a car. So it's a great way to distance yourself from the consumer world. That's my last small piece of advice.
Thank you very much, Pierre. It's been very, very enlightening. So Pierre de Vesian, your nickname on the forum is P. Vesian, V-E-S-I-A-N. So if anybody has any questions for Pierre, he's always available to answer them. So do not hesitate to write to him. Thank you, Pierre. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Well, thanks, Sandrine, for putting together all that great information, especially in that way of bringing three people together in three different perspectives. I thought that was a really creative and original way to kind of put a different spin on this topic of money and multipotentiality. In the Putty Peep profile this week, we have Maja Gray. She is currently into empowering people to live their inspired life through things like sailing around the world, jumping out of helicopters, and being a digital nomad. Where she lives, well, it's kind of all over the place. Maja calls herself a global citizen because she's basically spent the last few years traveling and living in various places around the world. For instance, just the last 4 years, she's lived in Spain, Sweden, Thailand for 2.5 years, and New Zealand, along with traveling to about 10 different other countries for shorter time frames. So she is definitely, as she says, location independent and quite proud of it. And this comes back to her website. She has what appears to be kind of a coaching consultancy kind of website. It's majagray.com, so MAJAGRAY.com, majagray.com. And you can check out a bit of her backstory. And it's kind of a blog and things like that, but also some resources for tapping into, of course, your potential, as we are multi-potentialites, and it's called Evolving Human is basically the title of her personal site, Evolving Human. So you can go and visit that and see the kind of things that she's up to. Now, Maja is one member of our community, and we've heard this a few times, but who says she's been a multi-potentialite long before there was ever such a word, and she says truthfully, she can't ever imagine not being one. Even growing up, she always wanted to try and learn different things. But this is neat. You know, I think a lot of us can relate to this as well. She says that there has been one constant in her life, and that is her love for the ocean. And that's kind of manifested itself in all sorts of various things she's done. In particular, she worked in the U.S. Coast Guard for 17 years. So obviously a big chunk of her working life. And that led her to working for an America's Cup team, you know, the sailing race. She was involved in three of the Volvo Ocean races. That would be an interesting thing to ask about. I've watched a little bit of that, but it seems fascinating, the kind of effort and coordination and planning that goes into these high-tech, you know, big-scale, big-business sailing races. So she's been a part of that. That's pretty cool. And, yeah, jumping out of helicopters to rescue people, a lot of things that kind of revolve around the ocean. So, you know, it's interesting that we, as multi-potentialites, we often pursue different projects, but within the kind of scope, the theme of a certain idea. So that's basically what Magia has done through most of her life. And as she says, she's just getting started. So that's Magia Gray, who is our Putty Peep Profile of the Week.